We keep returning to try to understand that civilization has an enormously complex of forms that are led by time. It's difficult to imagine initially, but imagine that time spontaneously occurs. And as it spontaneously occurs, it instantly blossoms space. And it's interesting because space blossoms in a paced way. It is paced by the energy frequency of time. And that energy frequency of time, as it begins to make an integral, space begins to have instantly a quality of thisness and thatness, which makes little dust motes, microscopic is too big. And all of that then begins to condense in a spectrum of, in a plasma that takes apparently something like 300,000 of our years to get integral enough to begin to have enough particles in the plasma to create the first stars, whose radiance, whose radiation, whose star winds begins to clear out the plasma and make what we call space, which is really a relational way in which phenomena begin to have a space-time relationality and a fabric. It's difficult to realize that culture is embedded in that universal time still. And beings like ourselves and our ancestral form were woven into the fabric of space-time such that wherever beings like us are, in whatever variants, we nest into the energy, frequency, wave of time, which gives us a comfortability. As soon as there is a complex culture that acquires enough language facility to go outside of the concourse of oral language, and you begin to have the complexity of sign, written sign languages, you begin to have numeracy. And this eventually blossomed into a literate written language about 6,350 years ago. And with that, those who learned to read and write had an increased facility to access vision, which is different from dreaming, which is very rare in the cultural realm, such that in the cultural realm, someone who has a visionary experience is considered ill, crazy, and they're ushered out of the tribe. Go and live in a cave until you get over that. And those who come back from that then have found their way back, and they became the shamans or shamanesses. But as soon as there was a population, not very large, who could read and write, they had a different access to vision. And because of that access, civilization has a triple time form that took a while to get established, and the first establishment of it was the first time that a written literate language was shareable among a few people, and it took about 350 years for there to be enough men and women that they could not fall back into the natural patterns easily, because they had developed a new quality of person, a person who would be aware of the regressiveness of wearing a mask. They no longer had personae, but they had spiritual persons. And they literally could not live en naturel easily any longer. That's about 4,000 BC. Adam and Eve could not stay in Eden. They knew they were naked. Not just naked in their body, but they were naked in the sense that they had more dimensions than nature was able to sustain and offer. So they had to go out in search of new conditions. It took about 2,000 years for that to secure itself to where the ordering of written languages, and thus the pacing of reading written languages, and thus the access familiarity with dimensions beyond vision, beyond the spirit person, into history, began to, about 2000 BC, create a criticality where the early developments of civilization had been taken over by the clutching of two tyrannical kinds of people. The most literate early writer on this is Zarathustra. And when he was 75, born, let's say, 2000 BC, in 1925 BC, he wrote his gathas in what is today Kabul. He was from Central Asia. He was from what is today Uzbekistan, from near Samarkand. He calls one kind Karpans, who rule with lies, and he calls the other group Kavis, who have no harad. They have no basic power to be true. And in my translation, here are two of the Hats from the 32nd Yasna, one of the great Gatha sections of Zarathustra. This is from 4,000 years ago. Those who prevent the teachings, fostering the best deeds of men, they speak of Mazda's retribution, defining life by judgmental speeches, and greed's truth is preferred. Karpans rule with lies. Those greedy, captive-holding Kavis, whom Herod is not held to, they say power is long custom. Thus prepared, deceit is helped, and death brought to life. But the deathless ones kindles help. It is a quality that had a tuned resonance to it, because a contemporary of Zarathustra was Abraham. Almost not only tuned, but lives that were parallel. At 75, about 1925 BC, just about the time the Gathas were being written in Kabul, Abraham found himself visioning that he should go to a promised land and went to what is today Israel. So that you have an odd situation by 2012 where Afghanistan and Israel, who have been tuned for 4,000 years, are in a kind of a nuclear war death dance, abetted and aided by Iran, which was where the Zarathustrian qualities came out in the best way, 2,500 years ago. So that we live not at a moment, but we live in the presence of a nightmare of deceit, of lies, of unbelievable insanity. And we are asked to be convinced that this is normal. It is beyond sick. And what we are doing here is we are combing out to make sure that we understand that the snarls are not natural, nor are they conscious. They are promoted again and again in overlapping complexities so that one does not understand fabric anymore. One understands only the patchiness of trying to repatch and repatch and repatch. In the Gathas, one of the most powerful words is Sraosha. Sraosha is the listening power that Lord Ahura has. The spirit helper of Ahura, who is man's helper, to be able to presence before Mazda. And Mazda is the eternal radiance, has a feminine tone, just as Ahura has a masculine quality. That Sraosha is the beginning of the Holy Spirit. And that Holy Spirit has a tunability of someone who is a friend to man, who is, in the words of, in translation of Zarathustra, is a man of light. And in the world as it is, in its confusion, those who really are successful, Zarathustra calls men of action. They get things done. Whatever that needs to be done, they can organize it. They cannot interface with the man of light. So the spirit guiding encourages a medium, and Zarathustra calls that community, noble friends. And that community of noble friends is able to hear the man of light and able to guide and help the doing of the men of action. So in that way, you get the flow of an eternal radiance through a taproot that helps the spirit helpers mature the noble friends so that they can configure in a real way, a good way, an ordered way, the men of action who create the structural circumstances of civilized life. Because of the axial quality of Uhura, the Lord, and Mazda, the radiance, because it's axial in a sense that all of time's energy is able to flow naturally, but is also able to braid consciously in such a way that when the noble friends come to have that braided quality in their lives, their flow becomes kaleidoscopic. They are no longer limited to the mental constructs of trajectories along limited ways. And one of the great Mahayana developments after about 500 years of the Mahayana in China is that you have paintings of bodhisattva helpers who are in a zero gravity. Their long furled costumes float behind them, and pretty soon you see that the dabs of color that you are looking at Matisse paintings 1,500 years ago. The largest collection of them is in an ancient oasis town called, in Chinese, Dunhuang. We say sometimes Tengwang, but Dunhuang. And it was at the end of two great caravan routes that put a parenthesis around the Gobi Desert. The northern arc was called the Silk Road, but the earlier southern road I named several decades ago the Jade Road, because as soon as that Jade Road was able to extend itself from the original place of jade into China, you find for the first time, all of a sudden, that the Chinese have dynasties. The first dynasty is the Xia dynasty, sometimes called the Phantom Dynasty, because there's no way, how did it come? It came by way of caravan routes from Zarathustran, ancient Central Asia. And the jade was in a place called Khotan, sometimes in modern Chinese, Hotan, but Khotan. And Khotan was at a place where out of the Dragon Mountains came two streams, and they crisscrossed exactly there at that caravan route. So it had plenty of water, it had plenty of vegetation, but it also had two kinds of jade. One stream had what is called white jade, sometimes a very light green, and the other black jade. And when the Xia dynasty is founded, you have not only jade and dynasties, but for the first time you have chariots. There are no primordial chariots in China. They're all of a sudden there, all at that time. so that the gifts of a huge civilization maturity coming into China brought all of this in literally one fell swoop. So that you have, about 100 years ago, a great studier of China, a sinologist named Bertolt Laufer, wrote a huge book of many, many hundreds of pages of all of the fruits and vegetables and things that Iran introduced into China thousands of years before. I'll bring a copy of it next week. He also did the great classic study on jade, because they go together. It is a quality that our 21st century has, but is almost not seeable because of the nightmare. And the problem is not to solve the nightmare, but to awaken from it. Because we now have men and women in zero gravity, and if they wore those kinds of gowns, they would float like those flying bodhisattvas of 1500 years ago at Dunhuang. We're combing through to try to understand that even with the best intentions, even supposedly with the best preparations, one can be so skewed that you can hardly believe it when you read it. We were talking last week about Vimla Sakar being a 21st century bodhisattva. She died in 2009 at 88. And how she was with Gandhi and Vinoba up until the late 50s, and then with Krishnamurti for many decades. And one of the qualities that came out of my association with the Gandhian people in India, I was with the World Without War Council, and we contacted the Gandhi Peace Foundation for the centenary of Gandhi in 1969. And out of this was in Berkeley, out of this there was a great concern centered in Berkeley, not just in the university, but with the city, the population in Berkeley, with Gandhi. And in Berkeley, in fact, Berkeley Hills Books in Berkeley, published in 2000 for the new millennium, the Bhagavad Gita as Gandhi saw it. And right at the beginning, it says in the editor's note, Gandhi's commentary was transcribed on the spot by his amanuensis, Mahadev Desai, and at least one other resident of the ashram, but not until 1955 was it published in its entirety in Gujarati. It first appeared in English in the collected works of Mahatma Gandhi, published by the government of India in 1969. And it goes on in that way, and that's not true at all. Here's the first edition in English. It was published by the Navajivan Press, the New Life Press in Ahmedabad, which is the Gandhian press, and it was published in 1946. But it was written down in 1933 and 1934 in English, and not able to be shown almost to anybody until 1942. But here's Gandhi. The following pages by Mahadev Desai are an ambitious project. It represents the unremitting labors during his prison life in 1933-34. Every page is evidence of his scholarship and exhaustive study of all he could lay his hands on regarding the Bhagavad Gita. And Desai was Gandhi's great secretary through every conceivable kind of situation. Until 1942, they were arrested in August of 1942, and Desai's physiology couldn't hold up, and he died 6 days later in prison. His place was taken by a man who was an assistant to Desai. His name is Purelal. And his Life of Gandhi are big, thick, huge, immense volumes. And the epitome of them is Towards New Horizons. Towards New Horizons, because the title is not so much the Gita according to Gandhi, but the original title was The Gospel of Selfless Action. And the Gospel of Selfless Action is the jewel of the Bhagavad Gita. And the sections of the Gita, the 18 sections of them, have dozens and dozens of verses, and each verse of each section is a facet, so that as you read or reread and reread and reread and reread the Bhagavad Gita, like one of those spheres in the party lights with all the mirror facets, creates this kaleidoscopic shift and change of perspectives that reading something written, giving you access to the infinite field of vision, discloses that it is fresh without end. You don't have to worry about being satisfied once and for all with completeness, because perfection is infinite. You don't have to worry about whether you have it enough, or you have it more, or you have to have more. All of those are concerns of being asleep and having the karpans and kavis conditioning you with lies and with grasping of power and control and judgments, so that one lives in a false judicial tyranny policed by politics, economics, and the military. And all of this is a confab. It is all illusion. It has no reality at all. At all. Not even a whiff of it. But only until we're able to have the dimensionality of history, where it is fresh from the spiritual person dimension, which is free in the quintessential fifth dimension of vision, do we finally come to understand a real analytic. That a real analytic is about possibilities and not just probabilities. It's not about achievements, but it's about explorations. There is such a thing as the adventure of life in a landscape, a starscape, that is immensity growing, growing in an immensity that is inconceivable, which is an infinite field. And this makes it difficult for people to understand that when you come to something like the great collection of essays by J.S. Bell, Speakable and Unspeakable in Quantum Physics, you cannot hope to understand mentally through a logical structure, because the reality is dimensions of kaleidoscopic possibilities multiplied indefinitely. Bell writing comes to essay 15. Cosmologists, even more than laboratory physicists, must find the usual interpretive rules of quantum mechanics a bit frustrating. Any result of a measurement of a real dynamical variable is one of eigenvalues. It's a mathematical dimension that is mathematically expressible. It has a conditioned applicability, but if the measurement of the observable is made a large number of times, the average of all the results obtained will be that average, will be the eigenvalue. So it's fictional, to put it politely. You can live by the fiction as long as you're deluded. A measurement always causes the system to jump into an eigenstate of the dynamical variable that is being measured. And then a few pages later, he goes into pilot waves. And we've talked the last month about pilot waves found by Prince Louis de Broglie and first expressed in 1926, 1927. And that the pilot wave mathematics was overrun and overshadowed one way inadvertently and one way definitely vertently. The one who steamrollered over it was Werner Heisenberg with the uncertainty principle. You're uncertain because the time and space don't meld. If you go to one or the other, the one or the other drops out of the measurability. Where does it drop to? It drops from phenomenality, which is guided always by an integral unity, a oneness. You better watch out. We're looking for the thing. We're looking for this, and we're looking for that. Now, if this and that have an identificationable quality, now we're getting somewhere. The person who brought the pilot wave back was David Bohm. He was enough of an outlaw genius. He refused to testify against his teacher, his friend, Robert Oppenheimer, in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee, and so they were coming after him. And when they come after you in that way, sometimes you're not heard of again. It's not just in present China. This is the McCarthy era of the United States, and it was severe. So Bohm left. He went all the way down to Brazil to get a university job so that they would not deport him. Finally, ended up in England because by that time he was quite respected. And one of his great little books, Causality and Chance in Modern Physics, with a foreword by Louis de Broglie, brought back in a terse way that was understandable that pilot waves are super essential to hidden variables. The variables outweigh kaleidoscopically the unity. The unities vanish into two related tunable ways. They vanish into zeros. So it seems like the absorption is complete. Or they vanish, especially mathematically, into infinities, where the mathematics of practicality is find ways to trick your thinking to comb the infinities out of the equation so you get the approximate, oh, it's close enough, isn't it? It's 99.9999, but it's not there because there's no there there. The zeros are omnipresent with the ones because you can't have a quanta without some space, however small, before and after and around. Otherwise, it's not a complete unity. And if you're looking for identification, that's what you have to have. They're not really there, ever. Let's take a little break. Let's come back to 1933, Gandhi, for most of 33 and a great deal of 1934, was put into prison. Again, he was always being imprisoned. And they had to watch him because when they put him into prison in 1930, he produced what has come to be known as the epic fast. And pretty soon it was the conversational topic not only everywhere in India, he will not eat, but in England. And finally the pressure, it was a seething ocean of pressure. You cannot let this man die this way. And so Gandhi said, I will break my fast. Usually he broke it by beginning with some orange juice. You can't just eat after a fast like that. One of the conditions was that he would accept the invitation to go to England to the Round Table Conference. And there at the Round Table were all of the British power figures. And there was Gandhi and Desai and one of his English Gandhians, all dressed in the homespun khadi cotton. And it was like this revelatory thing that, as Churchill called him, that little brown man, had hold of the great heart of the British Empire. He held it tenderly, and it began to make all the difference. So they allowed him in 33, 34 to be able to pass his time by studying the Bhagavad Gita. And he did so in a Gandhian way assiduously, because he was a karma yogi of the highest order. And that's a karma yogi does that. What we're doing here is an improvement of a Raja Yoga. This is a Maharaja Yoga. But Gandhi had this to say, and Desai wrote it down in 1933. He's talking about there's no real need to establish that the Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita was a historical figure. all questions of the quest for the historical Krishna become of subsidiary importance when we bear in mind the fact that the Gita preaches no exclusive doctrine, and that when the author of the Gita introduces Krishna as speaking first person, it is no personal Krishna speaking, but the divine in Arjuna and in every one of us. Krishna is represented as speaking in the name of God, Paraman Atman, beyond being, Supreme Brahman. The Svestasvara Upanishad is an unbroken praise of the Lord, whom it names Siva, but at no moment is the truth far from the sect Wu, the seer who composed the Upanishad, the one God hidden in all things, all-pervading inner soul of all things, the overseer of deeds, all things abiding, the witness, soul thinker, S-O-L-E, devoid of all qualities, the one controller of the inactive many, who makes the one seed manifold, the wise who perceive him as standing in oneself, they and no others have eternal happiness. The English word for that is presence. In Abraham's time, he was comfortable in a familiar living way of being in the presence of God. Later on, after some 600 years, you find that it has become a doctrine, it has become doctrinal in a mosaic way, that there is an angel of the presence of God. This is a different kind of reference wave than the one that founds Abraham's being comfortable just as the man that he was, when two powerful, really powerful angels come on their way to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham invites them to share the shade of a tree and have some food, and let's be together. Even with the incredible supernatural power that they have, he is at home, because his presence is a presence in eternity. His quality of presence was only able to be halfway delivered by himself, because that presence needed a joint, shared quality to come into play that only women carry. It's called mitochondrial DNA. And only the female babies receive the fertility of the mitochondrial DNA to pass it on. The male babies have it, but they cannot pass it on. Only the female babies can grow up to be the girls, to be the loves, to be the wives, to be the mothers, and pass it on so that they have the quality of continuity. And so the feminine has a continuum of fertility. The male has instances of fertility, but they do not have the continuity of fertility. So that wisdom is feminine. Athena, Sophia, the Lady Prajnaparamita. The continuity is that this is without interruption, and the way that the Hermetica recorded in the very first Hermetica, the Poem Andres, the creative mind shepherd, there is a point where Hermes Trismegistus is dialoguing with his philosophic son, Tot, and they get to the threshold where Hermes Trismegistus says, now we must pause and no longer dialogue because we are coming into the cascade of wisdom. And in order to respect her, we will keep silent. It is the articulation of the silence of the male in the presence of the continuum of feminine wisdom that allows for the love to be real, even though it's interspersed with complete empty openness. It always has the continuity of being at the same time perfectively there in the continuousness. This quality comes out in the Bodhisattva Vimalasakar, one of her nice little books. She liked to write little books, Beyond Awareness. As a friend, I plead unto you that the transcendence of all this tremendous inheritance is possible. You transcend something that is within you, and you find yourself beyond all the conditionings and frontiers in the space of silence. Enriched with the non-cerebral energy, you find yourself a different person altogether. Not that you find yourself a different person, but that you are continuously refining in that wisdom continuity. We mentioned Shraosha in Zarathustra about 1925 BC. The root in Avestic, the Avestan word root, expresses hearing, intent, listening. And 2,000 years later, Jesus constantly talks about those who have ears to hear, let them hear. You have to have ears that not only have the articulation of the language, but that the spacing between the words, between the syllables, also is a part of the expressiveness of what you are able to hear. And later on, when Mary Magdalene, who could hear Jesus speaking with ears of a continuum, she writes in the ninth ode to Solomon in this way. Open your ears, and I shall speak to you. Give me yourself, so that I may give you myself. The word of the Lord and his desires, the holy thought which he has thought concerning his Messiah, for in the way of the Lord is your life, and his purpose is eternal life, and your perfection is incorruptible. Be enriched in God the Father, and receive the purpose of the Most High. Be strong and redeemed by his grace, for I announce peace to you, his holy ones, so that none of those who hear shall fall in the battle. when their shared presence goes to India via the Apostle Thomas about 41 AD, within one generation, Thomas's double seeding, he landed in the south of India, the Malabar coast, and then proceeded by ship up the coast all the way to the northern part of the Indus River basin, what was then Gandhara. And in both places, he set in motion, like the two roads, parentheses, over the Gobi Desert, he set two great arcs, one in northwest India, what is today Pakistan, what is today Islamabad, and in south India, especially not so much, even though it was there on the Malabar coast, but across the little bit of the end of India to the far eastern part, and that Indian state is Tamil Nadu. And the Tamils have one of the most sophisticated poetic languages in India. There are many languages in India. But it's interesting to see the great city there used to be called Madras. No one is more sophisticated than Madrasis. They're all like a Krishnamurti. There, the Mahayana began to penetrate from the south into the north to come to meet what was being prepared as a ground, as a fertile population of people to receive this kind of an insight trigger coming from the south. The Lady Prajna Paramita is the poetic language speaking the new kinds of sutras. Not the old kinds of sutras of the traditional Buddha. The traditional Buddha was about being able to return back to the zero field, having completed whatever needed to be completed, but the new Mahayana, not the Theravada, not the way of the elders, but the great way, was to prepare for the bodhisattvas. And one of the earliest bodhisattvas is Avalokiteshvara. In Sanskrit means she who is able to hear your cries. She always listens, no matter how many hundreds of millions or billions are crying out. She hears each one in the cascade of attention which she has. And Avalokiteshvara becomes the only bodhisattva that becomes ambidextrous, can be male or can be female. And in this way is the mysterious person bodhisattva, who is able to hear each individually, but to hear it within the cascade of eternal attentiveness of presence. When you find beautiful academic books like this, Jewish women, philosophers of first century Alexandria, the only mention of Mary Magdalene in the entire wonderful book is just a little aside and saying there was another Mary, a Mary of Bethany, as if they were not the same person. One of the reasons for this is that almost everything that is important was effaced and then erased by an incredible cacophony of erasing. The University of Southampton in England has a marine archaeology department. And one of the great figures in that is Lucy Blue. She heads up the Lake Mareotis Reconstructing the Past, because in classical Alexandria, Lake Mareotis was about four times the size that it is now. It had the qualities of San Francisco Bay. It was surrounded by fertile wineries who, because they were exporting all over the world, had huge pottery kilns, who also had access to the grains and the fresh water of Lake Mareotis, the fish, so that you had fish, wine, and bread as the ceremonial characteristic of this area. And the ties between Lake Mareotis and India ran through a canal that reached the Nile and went down the Nile to a city called, usually by its Greek name, because it became very powerful in Hellenistic Egypt after Alexander the Great's successors. The city's name was Koptos, out of which the Coptic Christians take their name. But from Koptos on the Nile, above Luxor, it's about a four and a half day caravan through the eastern desert to Myos Hormos. And Myos Hormos, also the University of Southampton, has been doing huge digs for quite a long time there, archaeological evidence, now two big volumes. And it's interesting to note that on the Red Sea, when you go south, the place that's most conspicuous is where Ethiopia, now it's a little country called Djibouti that succeeded from Ethiopia, almost touches Yemen. In ancient times, 3,000 years ago, that whole complex was a single kingdom called Sheba. The capital of Yemen is now called Sana'a, taken from that. But in the ancient kingdom of Sheba, the powerful holy city was called Aksum, A-X-U-M. There, the son of the Queen of Sheba, Jesus referred to her as the Queen of the South, because her kingdom was the most wealthy kingdom, like his was the most wealthy kingdom. And when they finally got together, she went back to Sheba pregnant and had a son. His name was Menelik. And when he was 21, he went to find his father and to be the young man's son to the father, and found that the old Solomon had become corrupted by too much of everything. Too many women, too much money, too much power. So he did what his patrimony convinced him of. He went into the Holy of Holies and took the Holy Ark and took it back with him to Sheba. A few years later, when Solomon died, his kingdom split into two, a northern part called Israel, the southern part called Judea, and never has been put back together. The Samaritans are totally different. They're Palestinians, largely. The Judeans are largely Jewish, but not from the Solomonic line, but going recursively back to Moses. Why? Because Moses is the referent wave, but was the referent wave about 1350 BC, because the referent wave before that, 1,000 years before that, was Sargon of Akkad and his high end priestess, Eni Duwana. If we don't understand the rhythm of civilization time forms, we miss out on what's going on. And as we've been showing, 1,000 years after Moses, the reference wave largely shifts to Alexander the Great. And 1,000 years after him, it shifts again to Muhammad. And 1,000 years after that, it shifts to Sir Isaac Newton and Leibniz. Each time, what is happening is that language is increasing its complexity so that you have, finally, 350 years ago, 1650 AD, you have the ability to do an analytic of any amount of detail between 0 and 1, or back the other way, from 1 to 0. You can have differential equations, you can have integral equations, to any degree of specificity whatsoever. And it will be exact, but it will not complete the possibilities. The possibilities are literally infinite. In the 21st century, it is of the utmost importance for us to understand that incompleteness is not the correct word to use. Rather, all possible worlds. We're looking at the way in which there is a discrepancy because of complete miseducation everywhere in the world. It's difficult to find a population of people who are noble friends. The qualities are looked for, and the looking itself becomes popular discussion. But the maturation goes off into fractionization, which is tried to be lumped back into integrals, as if that were the answer, as if there were a question, as if there were a judgment needed to identify this is the answer to the question. We're going to take a look next week at one of the great Mahayana sutras called the Vimalakirti Nirdesa Sutra. It starts out where this man is ill and the Buddha wants to know how he's doing, and so he keeps sending emissaries to go and talk to him, and they all come back really confused and puzzled. And finally, the sword-wielding Bodhisattva Manjushri is sent by the Buddha, and he goes into this dialogue that increasingly brings out the fact that he is ill with the confusion of the world. He's not ill, but the confusion of the world makes it impossible for anyone to understand his health. He should be this way in these conditions. If the conditions are restored to health, he will be quite healthy. Increasingly, as we will see in the Vimalakirti Nirdesa Sutra, there are realms beyond realms, universes beyond universes, but not as meta-universes, but as facets of this particular, not universe, but as Vimalakirti will say, it is a triple cosmos that can be, if you're really healthy, you can bring that other universe and hold it in the palm of your hand and present it so that holographically everyone gets to experience what that is without its meta-ness. And 140 some million people instantly get it, and Vimalakirti gets a little healthier. We're going to take a look at that in detail next week. And we're also going to look at one of the most interesting female bodhisattvas of the 20th century, Marie-Louise von Franz. This is her little illustrated book on time. And it was a series that was begun in England by Jill Peirce and her contribution to her own series, The Mystic Spiral. There's about 30 or 40 of these volumes, and I'll bring a whole stack of them next week. But we'll take a look at Marie-Louise von Franz. She was the closest one to Carl Jung in terms of her brilliance, of her comprehension. And the visionary portal for her was looking at the maturation of children, hearing and then learning to read, and the art form which spans this are fairy tales. And the feminine genius of cascading continuity of wisdom in the hands of Marie-Louise von Franz is revelatory. Fairy tales are as distinct as can be from myths. More next week.